This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, Why Jesus is Your Greatest Hope on Earth and in Eternity, by Phil Robertson. Available now, everywhere you get audiobooks.
You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. And I'm your presidential candidate, Wade Bearden.
And my opponent is clearly not ready for the important job of co-hosting this podcast. I'm Kevin McClinathan, the real co-host of Seeing and Believing for America.
You thought the November election is going to be contentious. You haven't listened to Seeing and Believing.
We're going to make this an episode to remember, mostly for my stunning victory over my opponent.
Listeners, we're going to take a look at the political documentary, Boy State, directed by Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss.
And we're also going to be continuing our Summer of Darkness film noir series with a look at the great Ida Lupino's road thriller, The Hitchhiker.
It's Betrayal and Betrayal on this episode, episode 261 of Seeing and Believing.
I will skip the part where I brag for 3 minutes about how great and cool I am, seeing as we are all qualified young men of skill and character. People like that stuff.
Good, yeah.
People like that stuff a lot.
Some people say they're a sports junkie. I say I'm a politics junkie.
The harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph.
I'm playing this like a game. I would like very much to win.
I love it, boys. I love it. Where are you from?
I come from a very modest family.
I'm on the course to be the first one to graduate from high school.
I'm a progressive person, and I'm in a room full of mostly conservative people.
Our masculinity shall not be infringed.
I've never seen so many white people ever. I feel like everybody has this secret underlying need for bipartisanship.
A message of unity, as good as it sounds, is not winning anyone any elections.
Listeners, we are here with episode 261 of Seeing and Believing. Kevin, the world's getting crazier and crazier. I want to go back to a simpler time when you could pick up strangers on the side of the road and hang out with 1,000 of your friends at the capital of Texas.
Yeah, those were the days. Now it's all just staying indoors all the time, not talking to strangers, and definitely not seeing your friends.
Yeah. I mean, there's not even a chance that you could pick up a killer hitchhiker anymore. And I don't know. It all feels so sterile.
Oh, the halcyon days. They are truly halcyon. I don't even know if that makes any sense. This is what the quarantine has done to me.
We're cracking up. Listeners, we are excited about this episode. Episode 261, as I mentioned earlier. We're continuing our Summer of Darkness, our noir series. We're going to look at The Hitchhiker from Ida Lupino. That's from 1953. We'll get to that film here in just a minute. This episode of Seeing and Believing, however, begins with a review of Boy State, the new Apple TV Plus film from directors Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. Here's the film's official synopsis to get us going. Winner of the Sundance Grand Jury Prize, this rambunctious journey into the heart of democracy captures an unusual rite of passage. 1,100 teenage boys from across Texas come together to build a representative government from the ground up. Kevin, where to begin? Where to begin? There's much to digest here, and we're going to get into some details as we go on. First off, I want to ask you this. After watching Boy State, do you wish, while in high school, you attended a version of Boy State in the state of New Mexico? And does this depiction of the particular event in the film have anything to do with your answer?
Well, this film does make the process of going to boys or girls state. There's a girls only option, as the film makes clear right at the beginning. We only spend time with the boys only group, obviously, for this film. But the film definitely makes it look like a very interesting process. And given that I'm more interested in politics now than I was back in high school, I could kind of see the appeal of it now. But back in when I was actually eligible to take part in it, I probably wouldn't have been into it all that much. I will say that my wife actually was able to go to Girls State.
Oh, wow.
And absolutely hated every minute of it. She's not the sort of person who is into, you know, debating and political maneuvering. That's not really her cup of tea at all. So she made it sound like it really wasn't all that great. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like this might be an experience that is best left to the movie screen rather than doing it in person, which, you know, I enjoyed that screen experience quite a bit. I'm curious to know, since you are a Texan native, though, Wade, what you made of this entire experience.
Yeah, well, I'll kind of get into some details. But first, I would have loved to go to boys camp, boys state, because I definitely get this youth camp vibe where you're kind of coming together with a lot of people. You form friendships quickly. They're in the documentary playing a lot of sports. You're hanging out, eating together. There's a big competition at the center of all of this. It does seem kind of fun. And I watched the documentary and I thought, I would have loved to be a part of this. I wouldn't have loved to be filmed as I was a part of this, but I think it's definitely this fascinating take, and it is interesting because, okay, it is Boys State from Texas, as I understand. This is something that occurs across every single state with the exception of Hawaii, and so we get a particular version here, and I don't think it's any coincidence that Texas was chosen. When you think of Texas, you certainly conjure up in your mind a number of, you know, politically charged ideas about the state. And so, yeah, I think it's fascinating. Ultimately, I'm kind of mixed on the movie. In one sense, I watch this and it's kind of thrilling in a way to see this big competition, this competitiveness. On another side, I'm a little uneasy or uncomfortable about the whole process and the way this documentary was put together. So I don't know. I'll probably get into that a little more later. But overall impressions, I kind of like it, kind of not really into it.
Well, let's delve into that actually a bit, because I think that I share some of your reservations about the way that all of this is framed, even though it sounds like I might have liked it more than you did. When I was watching this film, what the comparison that leapt immediately to my mind, more than any other sort of politically themed film or other documentaries about youth, none of those were the first thing that occurred to me. The first movie that occurred to me as a comparison was The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. And the reason for that is that The King of Kong is a fantastically entertaining film. This is, you know, of course, it's the documentary that chronicles all of the fighting that goes on at the top levels of competitive Donkey Kong playing. You know, who can get the highest score, the world record, for playing the classic arcade game Donkey Kong. And it ends up boiling down to this kind of good versus evil grudge match between the reigning world champ Billy Mitchell, kind of this slick guy who's been at the top of the leader chart since he was a young man. And then there's kind of Steve Wiebe, who's this average Joe kind of husband and father who just discovers that he has a knack for it, and he's doing his best to sort of fight his way to the top, and he's sort of the underdog against Billy Mitchell, the evil guy who has the establishment on his side. And part of the reason that film is so entertaining is because the way the directors frame the conflict, they obviously are picking sides, right? Like Billy Mitchell is the bad guy, Steve Wiebe is the good guy, and the film is unapologetic about framing it that way and making it into sort of like one of these experiences where you can cheer for one side and boo against the other side. And I feel like Boys State kind of goes there as well, which is also, just like The King of Kong, it's very entertaining. I have more qualms about that approach with this film for a couple of reasons. First, there's the fact that, you know, these are still children, you know, they're still in high school. They haven't really grown up yet. And you get the sense watching this film that they're still kind of forming their ideas of who they are, who they want to be, and why politics is important to them. So kind of framing the action in a way that makes one side the good guy and kind of one side more of the bad guy is a little bit discomforting. Part of the other reason is I feel like the whole point of the film is to dig into the complexities of what makes the American experiment tick. Like why do the two parties kind of entrench along the lines that they do? Why do certain issues enjoy a bigger stage and more of a sideshow than other issues? All of those ideas are swirling around in this film, but it ends up being mostly the story of Steven. Steven is a young Latino man. He's the son of immigrants. He's kind of going to be the first person from his family to graduate from high school. He's kind of this go-getter type. And as the film goes on, you kind of realize he's kind of the main character. The film really adopts a sympathy for him. And because of that, his opponents, who are primarily white and who are kind of framed more as the sorts of political players who are going to do anything that takes to win regardless of principle, they kind of end up being the bad guys. And it's engaging to watch. It does raise questions about why the filmmakers are framing it this way, whether that's actually the way it was or whether it's being slanted in a certain way, and whether that's the most responsible and beneficial way to present this material to the audience.
Well, yeah, I mean, you kind of taken some of my argument and you say it so well, but yeah, they're just kids. I don't think I had crazy political opinions when I was 16, 17. I mean, obviously, I don't hold some of those same opinions, but I would have hated to look back and to hear me talk about my politics when I was 17, 18, especially to see that being used as this sort of metaphor about the American experience. And I thought of The Lord of the Flies whenever I watched this film in a way, but using children to say something about society. The problem is, this is a documentary. These are real individuals. And I don't think the documentary ever really allows us to see the seams of the story. So it's odd to me because a number of the main characters that were, in a sense, cast or chosen before the big event, they actually go on to hold high offices in this game, in this boy state. And it feels a little odd to me because they chose these individuals before the event, and then they go on and they do big stuff. That feels weird. And I feel like the documentary needs to explain it, because if this documentary wants to be objective, it has to let us know how it's being objective, or if it's being subjective, or it's really leaning in that direction. It needs to show us how it's moving there. There are speeches that are done, and characters come up and they'll give a speech, and we hear a snippet of that, and we hear about maybe abortion and gun control. And then the speech is cut and that person's done. And what I'm thinking is, was that the entirety of the speech? Why are those cuts there? And what is this documentary not telling us? And here's what's kind of interesting. This is kind of this personal connection. So our listeners can kind of take this as they may. But my brother's wife, so my sister-in-law, her brother was a part of this. He's a part of this boy state. And his name is Jameson. He listens to the show regularly. He's sent in tweets telling us about some of the reviews we've done. And he's in the documentary, and he's actually in the sequence where the talent show occurs, and he's tap dancing. So you'll probably remember that scene, and at the end, he does this tap. And so I this like jump up, and he does a heel click, and the crowd goes wild. And I wrote down in my notes, you know, Jameson tap dances his way into our hearts. But I texted him, and I was like, hey, just kind of give me, I don't know, give me some background. And he said a lot of good stuff about the documentary, about its portrayal of this hyper competitiveness, about how most of the students there, they are valedictorians, they are pretty popular in their school, and then they show up. There's 1,100 people who are just like them, and then there's this big competition to make it to the top. He actually. Was in, so they're divided and they get down to 25 people in like their city or something. And he was with Renee, who plays a big part in this documentary. And he ran against Renee for the Texas Senate and he beat Renee. So it's fascinating to see how the week changes and the documentary changes because Jameson defeats him. We don't see that in the documentary, but it's just kind of fascinating to hear the story. And one of the things he also said too is he said there was one character in the film who was kind of portrayed as almost like a villain. And he said, you know, everybody really loved him. He was a great guy. He helped out. He helped clean up. And he wasn't on board with that betrayal or sorry, portrayal. And so it has me thinking, what's here? You know, we get snippets of these characters and they're in interviews and they're talking, but how are these individuals portrayed and what does that mean? I don't know. It makes me a little uncomfortable, kind of like you, Kevin. And I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but that's kind of what's rolling around in my mind as I think about this movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to the comparison to The King of Kong, I feel like maybe slanting that tale in a way that is definitely biased in a certain sense feels, you know, it's either way, it's not really that big of a deal. Like it's just a video game. It's just, you know, like trying to get the high score in Donkey Kong. It's sort of like, it's the stakes seem a little bit like the stakes in the film are obviously very high, but ultimately in the grand scheme of things, the stakes are relatively low. This film, it does seem like it's really trying to say something about politics, about youth, about the way the roles that individuals can play in our political system to really make a difference. And that is a little bit of a cliche, but it is true that, you know, we do have this large system, but the system is made of individuals and individuals can move the needle in certain directions for good or for ill. And when the film kind of makes its aspirations in that direction clear, it does make the choice to be a little bit more bichromatic, more black and white in the way it frames the central contest between these two individuals to kind of be elected the quote unquote governor of Boys State. That does feel a little bit problematic or disingenuous or something. It feels like it's oversimplifying where it could have been so much more than that. I think back to there's a sequence late in the film where Steven is talking about the importance of compromise. And earlier in the film, he makes it clear that, you know, he's in favor of gun control. And this being Texas, you might expect that is a position that is not necessarily very popular among high school boys. And so Steven is kind of talking about how even though he's got this viewpoint that's not necessarily popular, he thinks it's important to go to the other side, to people who don't necessarily agree with him, and to just talk with them and try his best to learn from them, which is a really, it's a really remarkable viewpoint. And Stephen is obviously a very remarkable young man. But what I found striking about that sequence is that the filmmakers don't really let us see any of those conversations. We get kind of snippets on the soundtrack of them discussing abortion or immigration, and we get kind of snippets of what these conversations that Stephen is having with people who disagree with him. But we don't really, the film doesn't really let us dig too deeply into that. It kind of prefers to stick with the much more crowd-pleasing sort of conflict between the up-and-comer who decides to go for principle and be very, very humble versus the other side that's much more concerned with doing whatever it takes to win. And that does feel like not a flaw so much as a missed opportunity. This film, I think, could have been a lot more complex if it had been willing to kind of sit with those conversations and dig a little bit more deeply into why these young men believe what they do and the sorts of conversations that happen when minds are kind of changed. Because that's essentially what this film is about, is trying to win another political party, even if it's, you know, a party that's sort of fabricated for purposes of this program. It's about trying to convince enough people from the other side to vote for you because your vision or your program or your policies are better. And the fact that the film devotes relatively little time to portraying and letting us sit in on those conversations feels like there was something left on the cutting room floor that would have been maybe more instructive than some of what ended up in the final product.
Yeah, I mean, there's this really good sequence where it shows the compromises all these individuals are willing to make. So at the beginning and throughout this, the characters in the film, the individuals, they make it a point to say, hey, you know, we're in a pretty conservative place. I think most of the people here are conservative. Most of the people are white. And yet there are compromises made that maybe you wouldn't associate with a place like the state of Texas. And so we get this kind of fun sequence where they are making laws that seem like they could be pretty helpful. And it ends with this circling shot up at the Texas Capitol Rotunda. And the best Texas Capitol photography since Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. And so we get this kind of fun sequence. And I, like you, would have enjoyed digging into that because it seems like the film wants to say, hey, things could be bad, but also maybe there's hope. Maybe the younger generation is willing to embrace someone like Stephen. And maybe there are Stephens out there. But we don't fully explore that. It's something that's kind of quick, and instead we get the backstabbing. We get individuals making meme accounts to make fun of the other political party. And it kind of makes sense that this would happen because you got a lot of competitive people there, and it's kind of a game. And so I guess I walk away and I say, okay, this film wants to say something, but I don't know how much it can say. And the editing certainly is trying to make a point, but is it all just filmmaking, or is it actually connected to reality, to what really happened in that boy state? And then too, this is kind of just a minor fun quibble. We get a lot of shots of the Texas flag and the Texas Capitol. And of course, these students have shirts on them with the state of Texas, and it says Texas. But it just felt like the film was trying to say, hey, remember, this is Texas. Hey, remember, this is Texas. And so it's like, you know, I do that thing I mentioned a couple weeks ago where I write down Texas equals metaphor. And I think maybe you start to see the seams. Well, I say you start to see you start to see where the filmmakers are pushing really hard, and it comes across as a little too much for me at times.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because obviously this is just anecdotal, but I do remember, like, my freshman year of college, you know, meeting up with all the other incoming freshmen and everything, and you immediately knew who all the Texans were because they would tell you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I maybe not being a Texan, maybe that didn't grate on me quite as much. It just felt sort of like, hey, that kind of feels very, very Texas to me, an outsider. I do think that the film does make more of an effort to portray complexity maybe than you're giving it credit for. I think that there is one young man who ends up being kind of a supporting player in the grand drama of Stephen's attempted rise to the governorship. Robert McDougall, he's in the same quote-unquote party as Stephen. He actually runs against Stephen in the primaries, where they try to pick out who is going to be our nominee for this governorship. And Rob is this, he's kind of got this bro vibe going for him. He's very, he's very jocular. He's very outgoing. He's got kind of this manner of speaking that is very bluff and feels very much like your average high school boy. He's a very likable presence. He's very interesting because obviously he does not, he loses to Stephen in this primary process. And the film does feature some ruminating from him over the way that he ran his primary campaign and the lessons he learned from it. He kind of said, like, I kind of assumed that everyone here was going to be kind of more about having fun and making jokes. So I kind of tried to be really brash. And I learned from watching Stephen that actually what you need is somebody who can inspire people to be serious and take these issues seriously. And you kind of start off expecting him to be a stereotype, but he reveals himself as somebody who's a lot more politically progressive and also a lot more just a generally nice person than you might be led to expect from the initial impressions. He's very supportive of Stephen after he loses to him. He actually approaches Stephen at one point and says, like, hey, you know, I don't want to, like, attack you or anything. Like, I want to make sure that, you know, whichever one of us wins, it's still cool between us. And I think that the way the film portrays that dynamic is kind of what I was hoping for more of throughout the film, because I do think it's very interesting to watch the film not slot Rob into a type in the same way that Stephen's opponents are slotted into, but kind of lets his complexities out to play and gives him a good amount of screen time to sort of muse about what politics means to him and the weird incentives there are to lie or to trespass your own principles because you want to win. And I think the film's at its best when it goes into those places.
Yeah, and it definitely feels natural because even though Robert is a main player through the first part of the movie, he ultimately loses his party's he doesn't win the governor race, and he's regulated to the background, and it felt a little more natural, and it felt like, okay, we're not just picking and choosing the people who are going to be here at the very end and following them around. We're trying to see this through the eyes of other players, and I think that works pretty well. I like Renee a lot. I wish the character of Ben Feinstein, I don't know. I think he's one of the characters where he becomes the villain, and I definitely don't agree with many of the things that he says, but I wish he would have been a little more well-rounded, and I don't think the documentary gives that to him. Instead, we kind of, you know, he's what's wrong with politics in our world today, which is a lot to put on a teenage student. But I'll go back to this. I I thought that the documentary, I thought it was riveting. I thought it was emotional at times, especially when we get to the end. When we get to the announcement and we see who wins the overall prize, does Steven pick it up? It's very intense. I'm just kind of like squeezing my hands together, waiting for that announcement. And the documentary does know how to create suspense. And so there's a lot to commend about this, even if I do have a number of things that make me feel a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that you have to even question at all whether Ben Feinstein, who's the kind of the party leader of the opposition party to Steven's party, the fact that you have to kind of question, well, like, are we getting the whole story, or is he actually like this? I think that kind of points out the flaws in the film's approach, in that it could very well be that the filmmakers aren't really shaping the footage they have in any overtly biased way. It might just be that this is the way that Ben presents himself and the kinds of values that he has, and that's just the way it was. But the fact that you don't really feel like you can fully trust the filmmakers to be that even-handed and that kind of neutral in their approach to this material kind of speaks to the fact that they've created this situation where you know that they're kind of on one side of this contest, and because you know that, it does call into question the way that some of these young men are characterized. Are they characters, or are we actually seeing the real young men at work and doing their political maneuvering? It's just that lack of certainty feels less like productive ambiguity or subjectivity being used for interesting ends, and more just a lack of trustworthiness. And it's a shame, because like you said, Wade, this is a very entertaining picture and does cause provoke a lot of reflection on the way that politics work and the incentives it creates and the hope that's still possible, even though we're kind of in the middle of the real thing right now, and kind of it's a little bit less hopeful on this end of things. But for these boys at this gathering, there is still some hope that the right way of doing politics can prevail. And I think that the fact that this film is kind of able to encapsulate that is something to commend about it.
Yeah, and I think maybe something that would have helped is less cuts. Give us some more space to see these characters where they are. We're kind of jumping around a lot. Speeches are cut up. Interviews are cut up. Do something to let us know how these interviews are being framed and who these individuals are. Let us see them. Let us just kind of watch them to gaze. And I think that could have worked better. I will say this. I think Jesse Moss, one of the directors, one of his previous documentaries, The Overnighters, I think that film is great. And he has incredible talent. And his co-director as well, I think she was also a part of The Overnighters, Amanda McBain. There's a lot there, and so I look forward to seeing more documentaries from this crew. Listeners, that is our review of Boys State. It's the new documentary on Apple TV Plus. I want to make sure I get that right. Apple TV Plus. It's streaming now. You can check it out. If you do, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Tweet us at CBelievePod, at CBelievePod. You can also email us, seeingandbelieving@gmail.com. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be talking about The Hitchhiker from 1953 here in just a moment. Thank you. That song is Cogitation by Idyllic. Listeners, we are so proud of all of you, and we are so thankful that you have taken the opportunity to support us via our Patreon campaign. It's quick, it's easy, and it keeps our show going. Just hop on to patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. A lot of different donation levels, and one of our favorites is called the What Can You Buy for $5 level. It's got a lot of great perks. And Kevin, I wanted to ask you, what could someone buy for $5?
$5 would get you a collection of cookie cutters shaped as the heads of famous presidents.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you got Taft, you got Herbert Hoover.
Yeah,
got
Rutherford B. Hayes, you know, all the big ones.
Yeah, all the big ones and the small ones, of course. The ones we forget about, but they were president just like every other president. That's for $5. Now, how many do you get for $5? Just one or kind of a collection pack?
I think you just get a random assortment. I mean, the thing is, it's only $5. You know, your bang for your buck might not be all that great if we're being perfectly honest. So in practice, most of the cookie cutters are going to end up giving you a cookie that's just sort of like a amorphous blob that you're going to just kind of have to squint and imagine you see the outline of Rutherford B. Hayes's fantastic beard, perhaps, or, you know, Herbert Hoover's thinning hair on top. Like, you know, it's sort of like whatever, but you can just kind of use your imagination to help things along. I think the main attraction is more just the fact that you get to eat the heads of politicians, which I feel like a lot of people can sympathize with these days.
Yeah, I mean, it's a power move. I mean, think about eating. Think about eating Teddy Roosevelt. You got to feel like you're on top of the world. You're like, I took down Theodore. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt seems like the sort of guy who would be very much down for some good old head snacking. So I feel like he would be on board with it, even if it meant his own head was on the chopping block.
Yeah, no, he seems like that, you know, that type of guy. He's a rough rider, so... You know, listeners, you can check that out for $5, or you can head on over to patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. Like I said, we very much appreciate all of your support.
Yeah, we also really appreciate hearing from you over email and on Twitter. We did hear from an eagle-eared listener this time, Wade, and I knew this was going to happen eventually. Whenever we deal with a French film, there's going to be some mispronunciations happening. It's going to happen. Just going to have to make our peace with it. Film Spy 007, featuring Roger Moore as his little avatar photo, which I think that is well done. He says, "I'm cringing every time I hear the host pronounce Louis Malle as Malay instead of Mall." And I have to say it. You got us. I think that was my fault, Wade. I led you wrong. I just kind of assumed that it was French, so an E at the end means that it's got that A sound, but that just goes to show how little I know about our neighbors, our continental neighbors across the pond. So Louis Malle is the correct pronunciation. We're very sorry for the error.
Yeah. Well, and the Christ in Pop Culture official account responded and said that we were fired, Kevin.
Oh.
I don't know what to do about that. I figured we just kind of keep going. And if this never gets published, who cares? It's just for us anyway.
Yeah, you know, we'll be like that one character in Hot Fuzz who's sort of the neighborhood watch guy that just sort of sits in the room with all the video monitors, and people sort of forget he's there, so they forget to fire him, and he just keeps doing his job, even though nobody really remembers. So we can kind of take that as our work ethos going forward.
Yeah, well, it isn't the first time we've mispronounced a name, at least for me, and I'm going to say it probably won't be the last.
It's definitely not going to be the last. I'm sure we probably have mispronounced something on this very episode. So, you know, yes. You just got to make your peace with it and move on.
You just got to move on. Listeners, we also want to take an opportunity to thank you for supporting Christ in Pop Culture. You can become a member of Christ in Pop Culture for $5 a month, and you keep the site going. We appreciate that as well. There's some great stuff on the site. If you don't watch or listen to or read anything on ChristInPopCulture.com, you definitely need to do that. We got a couple of interesting articles that relate to television and film, Kevin, this week. KB Hoyle wrote an article on Smallville. It's titled Smallville's Storied Heroism. And I've never watched Smallville, but I know there are a lot of Smallville fans out there. Definitely check that out. And then MV Bergen wrote an article called Deliver Us, What the Prince of Egypt Has to Say About Suffering. And I need to check that article out because I'm a fan of The Prince of Egypt. It's been a while since I've seen it. I remember seeing it in theaters, and I've seen it a couple of times since then, but it's been a few years. But we appreciate that content on the website, and listeners, make sure to do that. And if you'd like, become a member of Christ in Pop Culture. Whatever you do, we appreciate all your support on Seeing and Believing. It's something that we very much enjoy, and we love seeing people come alongside us as we go on this film, this weekly film journey.
We're back with the second half of our show. We're going to leave behind the world of high school debates and clip-on ties for something a bit grittier, Wade. You expressed earlier a nostalgia for the days where you could just sort of pick strangers up on the side of the road just because they stuck their thumb out at you.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that is something that you are actually nostalgic for, or if it was something you were just playing up for effect.
You know, the answer is yes and no. No, because it is a little dangerous. Yes, because at this point, I just want the company of other people.
You're so very, very lonely.
No. This is one of those movies that'll make you think twice about picking up a hitchhiker if you didn't already think twice about it.
Yeah, well, it definitely wears that on its sleeve. In fact, the very first thing you see in Ida Lupino's 1953 film, The Hitchhiker, is a title card saying that what you're about to see has been based on true events and could possibly happen to you. This thriller slash film noir slash road movie is maybe the most meat and potatoes of all meat and potatoes thrillers, with more meat and more potatoes per cubic inch than any other film we've reviewed so far in this film noir series. The film follows two men on a journey in the American Southwest and in Mexico as they take some time off from their families to go on a road trip together. They pick up a hitchhiker who soon reveals himself to be the psychopathic killer who has gone on a murder spree across much of the American West, killing anybody who picks him up. As they take him on a journey to a port town so he can catch a ferry and escape, they encounter danger, not only from him, but from the elements and from their own anxieties. So Wade, like I said, this is kind of a meat and potatoes experience. This is a very lean sort of thriller with none of the, shall we say, Baroque plotting that you might expect from other film noirs, such as The Big Sleep. My question for you is, one of the things that we've experienced over the course of this entire series has been each film that we've reviewed has taken film noir tropes, kind of a film noir aesthetic, and put its own spin on that aesthetic for its own purposes. That's obviously true of Ida Lupino's stab at this film as well. My question for you is, what did you make of the particular spin that she found for this story?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating film. And from what I understand, it's the only noir movie from the 40s and 50s that was directed by a woman. And so we mentioned last week, Kevin, how our eyes were kind of going to be attuned, hopefully, to that. And there are a number of things that we'll point out throughout this review that hopefully will kind of walk viewers through what makes this one a little bit different from some of the others that we've reviewed. One thing that stands out, and I mentioned the femme fatale in Elevator to the Gallows last week, and just the tweak on that in that film. There is no femme fatale in this movie. And in fact, it's kind of revolutionary in that it's a noir that does not have a single female cast member. It is driven almost literally by this toxic masculinity, by an egocentric, psychotic killer. And really, that's kind of what we explore in this movie. The men here are not pulled into a web of deception by a woman. Instead, it's them and it's them alone, and they're trying to deal with the turn of events here. And so that's kind of fascinating. I'll also point out too, some of the heroes in the film turn out to be the Mexican police officers, and there's this Mexican detective, and he is extremely helpful. And in 1953, I wonder if that's revolutionary. I'm not sure. It feels a little revolutionary, but that definitely seems like it's a different stroke when it comes to noir films. And I like some of the twists here. I really do, some of the changes, because like you mentioned, Kevin, there's nothing really kind of special about the plot. It's really all about the execution, but I think the execution is very good in this movie.
Yeah, well, to your observation about the Mexican cast members, this is the same time period and the same genre that gave us Charlton Heston wearing bronzer in Orson Welles's Touch of Evil. So obviously, the American film studio system of this time was not shy about whitewashing roles for actors of Latino descent in its film noirs. So whether or not that's revolutionary, I don't know if maybe it merits a label that great, but it's definitely maybe a little bit out of the ordinary from what you might expect from a more mainstream release like this. One thing that I found interesting about this film was that setting and the way it's used. I mean, I was thinking a lot of Welles's Touch of Evil while watching this film, because that, like this film, is set kind of in a desert town in the Southwest. There's a lot of contact with Mexicans and with people, kind of the sorts of people who live right along the border, and very much concerned with that milieu. But Welles's approach to that is he still kind of bathes a lot of his film in shadows. There's a much more recognizably noir aesthetic, or conventionally noir aesthetic, to Touch of Evil that you don't really see as much of in this film. In fact, this film is almost oppressively sunbathed. It's film noir where the darkness is kind of replaced by this skull, white skull bleached by the sun aesthetic, where these guys are just, they're in a very inhospitable environment. They're being held at gunpoint pretty much 24/7 by a psychopath, and there's really no escape for them. So in that way, it does feel very recognizably noir, in that they're entrapped, just like so many noir protagonists are entrapped by their circumstances. And Lupino just kind of lets that play out. She doesn't do any cutting away. I read a review that made much of the fact that there's no attempt to sort of cut away to these men's families as they kind of wonder where their husbands have have disappeared off to, and kind of trying to inject a drama that way. This, we stick pretty closely to the three men in that car, cutting away slightly to the investigators who are kind of trying to catch this killer, kind of as a police procedural more than a conventional drama. And I think that again kind of contributes to this oppressive feeling where these men maybe shouldn't have just kind of gone off on their own without really telling their wives where they're going, because they're kind of looking to go off the reservation, so to speak. They kind of want to go off and have a good time on their own. And it's that kind of desire to break the bond, break what they see as the shackles of domesticity, that kind of gets them into this fix. And the rest of the time they're spent kind of paying the price for that. And that does feel recognizably noir, even if there aren't any Venetian blinds casting shadows across their faces.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is funny because the killer at one point implies that maybe they weren't being as pure in their intentions with the trip as maybe they should have been. And as a result, their potential sins, or at least mistakes, get them in trouble. It's fascinating too, because most noirs, they are set in these kind of claustrophobic cities. And they're obviously, some of the main characters are people who are cut off from society. Here, the setting is different. It's in the Southwest, in parts of Mexico. And we trade this, as I mentioned, claustrophobic, uninviting city for a harsh, uninviting desert. These landscapes that further emphasize how these characters are cut off from society. And there are a couple times when God is referenced here. One of the characters tells a young girl to go with God because she's kind of escaped, or he thinks she's escaped from the killer who could have done something to hurt her. There's another point where one of the men yells, "Oh, please, God, hear me." And the killer says, "Leave him alone. Can't you see he's praying?" And there's something about the image of a man without any strength, a man who's held at gunpoint in the desert, praying to God and wondering if he's hearing him. And so it further emphasizes the spiritual alienation of these characters here in the story. And then there's something else too that I found fascinating is I was reading that around this time is when interstates became more popular. And so this is also with new technology comes new problems. And we see how this world is changing and the people are struggling to catch up with that change. So on the surface, like I mentioned, it might not look like much, but there's a lot going on here. And I think this film deserves to be recognized as one of the unique noirs of classic Hollywood.
Lupino makes really good use of the camera in this film as well. Circling back to your comment about God and about kind of this sense of abandonment that is a thread that runs throughout the picture, Lupino often chooses to shoot the car as it travels along these dusty dirt roads from a very high angle. There's a sense of observation that this camera is allowing us to assume perspectives outside of these men's situation for just an instant. The way that this film is cut together is very propulsive. There's kind of a short vignette at a gas station, and then there's another one of these high angle shots of the car driving down the road, and then they get a flat tire, and so they have to get out and fix that, and then they do, and then there's another high angle shot of them making a turn onto a different road. And the way that these little flashes of a different perspective serve a couple of purposes, it does accentuate the feeling of abandonment, of loneliness, again, of the entrapment of these men just all by themselves on lonely roads with this remorseless killer in the back seat. It emphasizes the fact that maybe there is somebody watching who just chooses not to intervene at some point. And it also, the propulsiveness of these, of the film's pacing, make this, give this film a real lean quality. Like, this is not a film that is going to waste your time. This isn't a film that's going to give you a breather. You're kind of stuck in this story all the way through to the bitter end, just like the characters. To quote Double Indemnity, it's straight down the line. And there's going to be an end point one way or another. Somebody's going to suffer some violence by the end of this journey. And everyone knows it, and the audience knows it as well.
Yeah, and I think the performances at the heart of this are really great. Edmund O'Brien and Frank Lovejoy play the two fishermen who are captive, and William Tallman plays Emmett Myers, this killer. And when he sleeps, he keeps one eye open, which is this nice sort of creepy effect. And you know, Emmett throughout the film emphasizes his freedom. So if we're thinking about noir and we're thinking about agency and personal freedom, he is someone who says, I'm going to do what I want when I want to do it. At one point, he says, somebody says, have you ever been on the other end of a gun? And he says, no, and I never will. And that becomes a treasured thing for him. The gun is how he does that. And this is nothing, I would say, new. I don't know if it was new at the time, but it definitely feels like the gun is this phallic imagery throughout the movie. And there's something here about this man's masculinity and how he uses that weapon to control individuals. And when the gun is knocked out of his hands at the end of the movie, everything changes. He is unable to take anyone in a fight. He's handcuffed, and he's seen as sort of this coward, and he freaks out because he has lost the thing that is most treasured in life, and that's freedom, and that's power. And just kind of observing that, you know, Lupino or Lupina, hopefully I'm pronouncing it right, and seeing what she chooses to highlight, and the compositions and the angles there, they produce a startling effect. If I would say there's one weakness to the film, so throughout the movie, I got a little irritated because I felt like the two men should have taken their chance to run away earlier. And towards the end of the movie, they do have a chance to run away, and one of them, their foot gets caught, and they hurt themselves. And the other individual comes back, and he allows himself to be captured because he's not going to allow himself to leave without his friend. And there's something sacrificial there. And the killer says, hey, like, the reason that you didn't escape sooner is because you both wanted to escape. You weren't going to be selfish. I kind of felt the opposite at first, early in the film, because it seemed like somebody could have, you know, these soldiers who, one of them is a soldier or was a soldier in World War II. One of them could have, you know, sacrificed themselves and maybe gotten shot and saved the other and took an opportunity, and they didn't. So at the start, I was kind of thinking, oh, is the film going to come around and say, oh, they didn't escape because they were both being selfish and neither one wanted to take a bullet for the other? But then the movie comes around and says, no, actually, they weren't selfish. They were waiting for both of them to get away. And so it doesn't always work at that level, but that's kind of a minor thing overall in the grand scheme of this film.
Yeah, I don't know if that bothered me as much because it did. I mean, on a surface level, it does seem that is the case, that there were opportunities that these characters, that the script kind of had them not take because there wouldn't be a movie if they had taken them. But as the movie goes on, it seemed to me more to be kind of a piece of the noir film where a character in a noir doesn't always act rationally or in his or her best interest. They're kind of again, I keep coming back to the operative word, entrapped. There's something in the universe that is keeping them in this negative cycle that they're trapped in, or in this plot that they can't extricate themselves from. And I think that might be the most noirish thing of all about this picture is the fact that these characters, yeah, you know, maybe they could have teamed up against this one guy and one of them would have gotten shot, but it would have been okay. You know, maybe they could have been a little bit braver because they'd, you know, seen combat in a literal war before, but they don't. And that tension of, well, why don't they? You want them to so badly is, I think, very productive of noir as a whole. I think it also serves another purpose in that it kind of, you know, the fact that the killer does taunt them for that, saying like, you idiots, you guys could have done a whole lot better for yourselves if you had just had fewer scruples like me. I think Lupino does a really interesting thing in that she lets the killer's perspective be a little seductive. I mean, you're never really sympathizing with him or on his side or kind of enjoying his actions, but you do kind of see things through his eyes a little bit. There's a really great shot in maybe the first act of the film. So the hitchhiker hasn't been in the car for too long. They kind of get out to take a break and read a map and kind of figure out where they're going. And the killer decides sort of like he's going to play a game with them. He's going to torment them a little bit. So he has one of them go out and hold out a beer can in his hand. And he says to the other passenger, he says, you have to take this rifle and you need to shoot that can out of your friend's hand. If you don't, I'm going to shoot you. And Lupino uses her camera and places it right behind the barrel of the gun and kind of lets the audience experience what it would be like to be looking down the sights of that. There's kind of this queasy tension, obviously, because it's incredibly dangerous, but it also puts the audience in mind of what the killer says about having a gun, the power that it gives him, the security it makes him feel to be the one holding the gun, not being the one who has the gun pointed at him. And the camera tells the entire story there. We never experience looking down the barrel of that rifle from the guy holding the can, his perspective. We only see it from the perspective of the guy who's about to take the shot. And I don't know, if that's not noir in some way, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of power dynamics going on in this film. And, when you think about, when you think about a story where a good person has a gun on a bad person and they're holding them prisoner, what's the tension in that story? Well, the tension is that the good person will let down their guard and the bad person who's, you know, powerful will attack. In this film, it's the opposite, right? We get this purely from the perspective of the two individuals. So they look at it as, oh, I'm always at risk, versus us looking at it and saying, well, the killer is always at risk because one moment he turns the other direction, he could be attacked. So we definitely get this picture from the perspective of a menacing evil there's really no way to escape. They are kind of all-knowing, all-seeing. He doesn't even go to sleep. His eye stays open at all times. So I definitely understand it. It's still kind of a little frustrating because it's like, oh, just jump on the guy when, you know, he's doing this. And but as you mentioned, it feels very noir, and there's something kind of that works about it despite the frustrating nature, which maybe that's how we're supposed to feel. Maybe we're supposed to feel very frustrated because we can't do anything, and that's what we're supposed to feel in a story like this.
Yeah, that's definitely maybe a good place to leave it for now. Listeners, that is our review of Ida Lupino's The Hitchhiker. If you've had a chance to see this film, or if you're interested in checking it out after hearing this review, it is streaming for free with Amazon Prime, so you can give it a look and let us know your thoughts. As we've mentioned before, we love to hear from our listeners about what they're watching and what they think of the films that we've been watching. Wade, I think that wraps up this episode. We're going to move on. There's at least one more film left in our Summer of Darkness series, and maybe it'll extend beyond that. Who knows how long the Summer of Darkness is going to last?
Who knows how long this Year of Darkness is going to last?
Hey, you said it, not me.
Yeah, we still need to tackle at least one neo-noir film. So we're still kind of dialoguing back and forth which one we should look at. So listeners, if you have any suggestions, make sure to send those in at CBeliefPod on Twitter, at CBeliefPod. You can also email us, seeingandbelieving.capc@gmail.com. That's the end of the episode. Make sure to rate and review the show. Share it with someone who appreciates a little darkness in their life. Send them the noir series. I hope they enjoy it. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. It's brought to you by ChristandPopCulture.com and our Patreon supporters. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLenathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.